You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Wisconsin DNR is asking for the public's help in reporting active bald eagle nests, especially in the southeastern part of the state. We'll find out how you can help. Bald eagles have gradually made a comeback here in Wisconsin. The state DNR is now asking for the public's help in tracking eagle nests, especially in the southeastern region of the state. Sharon Fandel is a field ecologist for the Department of Natural Resources covering southeast Wisconsin. Sharon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So what are you asking for members of the public in helping track bald eagles and their nests?
Well, generally, we continue to see the bald eagle population expand across the state, and particularly across the southern third of the state. And notably, last year was our first reported occupied nest in Kenosha County, which hadn't previously had any nests in it. And it sort of triggered this, hey, why don't we reach out to the public and find out, is anybody seeing eagles in other parts of southeastern Wisconsin where we don't have reports of documented nesting?
And do I have this right, Sharon? We've spotted eagle, in general, we know there have been eagle nests, bald eagle nests, in every county but two in Wisconsin. Is that right?
That's correct. The last two counties that we've not had a report on are Walworth County and Milwaukee County.
And do you look for reports from people in general all over the state at the DNR for bald eagle nest sightings?
We tend to get reports from all over the state, and we take in those reports, and a lot of the nests that we hear about, we already have documentation of them. But even in southeastern Wisconsin, where I've been covering, we continually, year after year, get reports of new eagle nest sightings that only add to our data and let us know that the population continues to expand.
If someone's out there and would like to help, but they don't know necessarily how to spot a bald eagle nest, what are they looking for?
Well, bald eagles are, especially the adults, are pretty obvious to the naked eye. Really large, dark-colored birds with white heads and white tails. The juveniles don't have the white heads and white tails, so they can be a little more challenging to identify. Other birds that you might get them confused with could be turkey vultures, which we have plenty of in the state. And occasionally during the winter months, you can get it confused with maybe a golden eagle, but that would be more rare.
And suppose someone thinks they've found a bald eagle nest. How do they then report it to you at the DNR?
Well, if you think you're observing an active bald eagle nest, or the adults incubating eggs or repairing a nest, we encourage people to report their sightings in a couple different ways. One is the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas is ongoing right now. We're in the fourth year of that five-year effort, and there's an online internet platform that you can enter your observation data. It's similar to eBird. It's on the same platform. People can also report it through the department's reporting tool for non-game animals, and it has a lot of handy drop-down menus that people can choose from to fill out their observations. Or if, say, they're in southeastern Wisconsin and they observe a nesting bald eagle, they can contact me directly. And if they're in another part of the state, they can contact their local bald eagle survey coordinator.
When you get these reports, Sharon, do you go out and try to confirm at least some of them and actually spot the eagles yourselves?
Yeah, it depends. Typically, if it's a report of a new nest, we try to get as accurate a location as possible. And if staff time allows, we make a visit to confirm the breeding or nesting activity. Occasionally, it's not uncommon that we rely on local bird surveyors that are in that area and have them go check it out for us. Or, you know, if we're not able to get to it, we definitely make a note of the location and file it away and try to put it on next year's survey route to check out.
Talking to Sharon Fandel, field ecologist for the Department of Natural Resources covering southeast Wisconsin. They're looking for your help in spotting active bald eagle nests, especially in Milwaukee County and Walworth counties, the last two counties we need to collect to have bald eagles spotted in every county in the state. And Sharon, that's quite a good place to be compared to where bald eagles were really not that long ago, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, can you talk about the recovery story of the bald eagle?
Sure. Well, a lot of people are probably familiar with that story, but they their numbers took a pretty big nosedive in the mid-century thanks to some of the pesticides we were using, most notably DDT. A lot of people are familiar with that. And following the ban of DDT, we saw bald eagle numbers starting to recover. So not only with the banning of DDT, but some other protection measures for clean water, for their nest sites, for their nest trees, and those sort of things, we saw numbers continually start to increase over the years. And ever since the department's been conducting this survey, since the early 70s, we've, with the exception of only a few years, we've seen end-over-end increases across the state in occupied bald eagle nests.
Now, Sharon, I know the bald eagles themselves, they don't care about county lines here in Wisconsin. That said, will it be exciting for you if and when we hit the point that, yes, we've confirmed bald eagles in every single county in the state?
Yeah, I think it marks a certain achievement in some ways, or it speaks to the resiliency of these birds and of the population, and to the efforts that have been put in place to protect these birds.
We'll leave it there for now. Sharon, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sharon Fandel, field ecologist for the DNR covering Southeast Wisconsin. She joined us for a look at how the public can help track bald eagle nests, especially in those last two counties, Walworth and Milwaukee County, where we haven't confirmed sightings of them yet. In the world of high school sports, there's a lot of soccer, track, and baseball this time of year, but another spring sport represents Wisconsin's outdoor traditions, clay target shooting. 78 schools around the state are part of a league with over 1,200 student participants who compete with each other, often virtually. Paul Leithan is the coach of West Salem High School's clay target shooting team. He's also the automotive and welding instructor at the school. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here.
And Evan Rao is also with us, senior at West Salem High School. Evan competes on the clay target shooting team. Evan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, no problem.
And Paul, let's start with the basics here for people who haven't done this before. Talk about how clay target shooting works as a sport.
Each round consists of 25 clay targets, five per station. The students are grouped into five-person squads, each starting on a station, and one at a time, in sequence, each student gets a chance, says pull, the bird automatically, or the clay target automatically, leaves the trap house, and the student shoots, and then it goes to the next student at station number two. When he's or she is ready, they say pull, and the bird or clay target comes out. They shoot and is continuing after five shots at one station. The students then rotate to the next station, and it starts all over again until all participants have shot 25 clay targets.
And Paul, are most of the students who participate in clay target shooting experienced shooters, or do you have people who come in with no background with firearms?
We have a wide range. The High School Clay Target League, a little bit of a misnomer. We have students from 6th grade all the way to 12th. About half of our students are in middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and the other half are in high school.
And Evan, let me ask you, how did you get involved in the sport?
Really, I started when I was young. I've been holding a gun ever since I could hold it up, practically. And, I started just hunting, and then through 4-H, I found traps, and my family shot a lot of traps, and then I just grew to love the sport, really.
And, Evan, talk about your team. This is your first official season in the league. How did the team come together?
Yeah, we're a really young team, actually. We only got, I think, two seniors on our team, so we have a lot of potential to grow, but we got 30-some kids out this year shooting, and it's our first year, so it's a really good turnout for a smaller school like we are.
And, Paul, you said he or she, there's not like a boys' league and a girls' league, it's all one team?
That's correct. Male, female, from 6th through 12th grade, we've got students of varying abilities. Some kids, for the first time, are starting out, and students like Evan have been shooting for quite a long time. And it's pretty cool because we've partnered with our local Rod and Gun Club, and they usually have 5 to 10 to sometimes 15 adult experienced trap shooters that are there helping us, you know, make this thing safe, make this thing happen, and make it happen so that especially the young shooters, you know, learn the fundamentals and are able to get better each week.
And one thing that's kind of interesting to me, Paul, I understand you generally compete virtually. You each team would go out and shoot. You don't have to get all the teams together. This is saving on transportation costs, which is especially going to help the smaller rural schools.
Absolutely. We shoot at our local Rod and Gun Club, and all the other schools shoot at their local Rod and Gun Clubs. And at the end of the shooting week, we report our scores, and then the students are able to access their scores and find out, you know, where our team stands amongst the other teams in our conference. And individually, they can find out where they stand within the conference and in on our team.
And Evan, you say you've been shooting for a while. You've done clay target shooting. Does it feel different, though, getting out and representing your school and competing in the sport?
Oh, very much so. I mean, when you're just shooting trap with your buddies, you don't have as much pressure on your back. You're not really thinking about it. You're still having a good time both times, but you feel that pressure just beating down on you. You got to do good for your team so your team has a chance to make it and go far.
And, Paul, I mean, your team is new. Your school is new in the league. Do you feel like you've got a good competitive chance here?
Absolutely. Evan said we're not real experienced. We have younger shooters, but a lot of our younger shooters, middle school age shooters, have been doing this for, you know, a few years. And this last week we had a shoot and we had 4 shooters get a perfect 25 out of 25. That's tough to do.
Evan, is this something you can pull off, 25 out of 25?
I was one of the 4 last
All right. All right, Evan, before we let you go, what are your goals for this season?
I mean, my goal is bring good leadership to our squad, I guess, and I mean, just keep this trap thing really get going, get it started. So bringing the younger generations up and get them to shoot instead of sitting on the couch eating potato chips.
Evan, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Paul, thanks a lot.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
We've been talking to Paul Lethen, coach of West Salem High School's clay target shooting team. Evan Rao is a senior there on that team. The U.S. Department of the Interior and Secretary Ryan Zinke recently promoted what they see as their biggest recent successes, listing more than 50 achievements. Those include efforts to address a maintenance backlog in national parks, initiatives related to wind energy, and conservation issues ranging from changes in status for certain protected species to big game migration corridors. But our next guest says the Department of the Interior has missed a big opportunity to support Native American tribes who want more autonomy on whether to extract energy resources from their tribal lands, including coal, oil, and natural gas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Native American tribes should be allowed more autonomy to pursue energy development on their lands? Could it be an economic boost? Would you have environmental concerns about a potential change? If you live on tribal lands yourself, what do you think of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Katie Tubb is with us, policy analyst for the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Katie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Rob, thanks for having me on.
Well, why is this important that the U.S. Department of the Interior make this change? What opportunities do you see out there?
Well, I think there's a huge opportunity for at least Native American communities to have a choice in the matter. You know, I'm not advocating that we make decisions for them. What I'm advocating for is that they have the freedom to choose. And I think what's missing in the process as it is now is that autonomy. And a lot of that resides in the Department of Interior. One of the biggest problems is the regulatory process that tribes and outside companies that want to partner with tribes have to navigate this very complex regulatory system. And I think that's the opportunity for Secretary Zinke is to take a good look at that and see how we can streamline that process.
I know issues of federal law and tribal sovereignty can be pretty complicated in a legal sense, but broad strokes, what would be different from a tribe wanting to exploit coal or oil or natural gas resources on their land versus another project that has nothing to do with tribal land?
It's a good question, and I don't know if you're at all familiar with the issues on federal lands within a certain state, but it's very similar to those issues where a company coming in and wanting to lease a certain tract of land or access an underground resource has to go through the federal permitting process. But in addition to that, working with Native American communities, you have to go through just additional layers of regulation. So it's similar to what we face on federal lands, multiplied by two or three. And to give you one concrete example of that, regardless of the project, you know, above ground or below ground, any lease or even just application has to be reviewed by the Department of Interior and go through what's called the NEPA process, National Environmental Policy Act, as well as going through reviews for cultural preservation, which is unique to Indian lands. And from my perspective, I think who has the most incentive to protect cultural artifacts and lands of significance but Native Americans? So it's this mixed incentive line structure that I think doubly complicates the process on Native American land.
Is this a hypothetical issue, Katie, or are there significant reserves of these various resources on tribal lands to where this could be a real live issue?
Yeah, it's definitely an issue. And again, each tribe, each community is different about, you know, if they want to access those resources. So that all has to come into play. But let's see. There are, I would say, roughly 5 billion barrels of oil on Indian lands. We've got trillions of cubic feet of natural gas, coal, uranium. These are not minuscule resources. There's a lot of opportunity there should tribes want to access it.
Talking to Katie Tubb from the Heritage Foundation, she says the Department of the Interior should review tribal sovereignty when it comes to development of energy resources on tribal land. She says the bureaucracy, the regulations are too strict, not giving enough autonomy to tribes. Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Waukesha. Brian, hi.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I just thought how the way we see sovereignty in the United States, it's a very sacred and protected issue and a very sensitive issue. We don't want anybody from any other country telling us how to run things. And we just, if we applied our standard of sovereignty to the Native American lands that are supposed to be their sovereign territory, it would seem that we would have not much to say at all about how they use their things, their resources, and would seem like a bunch of great overreach to me if we did tell them how to use their resources if it's supposed to be their sovereign nation land.
Brian, thanks for the call. Katie, that's part of the case you're making, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think it all kind of boils down to incentive structures. Bureaucrats in D.C. don't have a whole lot of incentive to make wise decisions about land management and environmental issues that they don't face the consequences of. You know, to give you maybe a general example, not many of us clean our rental cars before you return them, but we sure do take care of our own personal cars. And it's the same way with land. You know, Native American communities have no opportunity to benefit from land management, and those decisions are taken out of their hands, you have a lot of wasted opportunity, and you also have a huge chance for mismanagement because the people responsible for those decisions don't face the consequences of those actions.
Now, back in 2015, there was a bill in Congress called the Native American Energy Act. It passed the House, didn't end up ultimately getting passed, though. It was trying to do similar things, it sounds like. Do you think that this is something, if it doesn't come to the Department in the Interior, could come from Congress?
Yeah, so actually Congress has done a good job to try and give Native American communities more say in the matter. They've tried to streamline things. A good example is the 2012 Hearth Act, which helped streamline accessing resources above ground, so things like timber. That doesn't apply to resources like oil and coal, natural gas. But even then, we still have regulatory issues. So with the Hearth Act, which was a huge move in the right direction to streamline, you still have federal okays that need to be checked off the list. So I feel like we're getting there. Congress is getting there. But we need to keep moving forward.
Now, one concern that came up when this was in Congress back in 2015, I think, was that this might be a backdoor to letting energy companies gain access to land. If they found a friendly partner in a tribal government, say, it would restrict the ability of other tribal members to protest, raise environmental or heritage concerns. Is this something that that could be taken advantage of?
You know, I think that all comes down to letting people make decisions for themselves, letting tribal governments regulate energy development as they see fit and as their systems of government create those checks and balances. You know, certainly there have been mistakes that have been made. I mean, I think states have experienced that as well, where they have systems in place that aren't followed, but then there's legal repercussions for that. And I don't see why that's any different with tribes, that they can come up with regulatory systems that allow a proper give and take between companies and their people.
I want to bring on another caller now. Eric is on the line in Eau Claire. Eric, hi.
Hi, thanks for the call. Yeah, I guess I'm just mirroring the last caller's concern is that, you know, Native Americans have so much land taken from them that they may not be in an economic state to make the best choices at times because they haven't had the resources that we potentially took away from them in the first place. And so setting up their own regulations could be a conflict of interest or could be very much helping big oil, gas, coal companies.
So, Katie, it sounds like a poorer tribe might be in a tough negotiating, bargaining position with a big energy company. Eric is worried that the temptation of money might corrupt the system, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I would point you to the example of the Southern Ute tribe. They also felt like they didn't have the expertise, and so what they ended up doing was placing a moratorium on all energy development within their territory, and then they educated themselves, brought in outside people to help them know what resources were on their lands, how you develop them, what the give and take is, you know, the pluses and minuses, and then they themselves set up their own company to contract with other people to access these resources. So there definitely is an education component. Just as states have had to learn, for example, how to navigate the fracking boom, that was an education experience where they had to figure out what the risks are and then develop regulations accordingly. And I think tribes are fully capable of doing that as well. And I think, again, you know, the Southern Ute tribe is a great example of how that can be done.
And Katie, as we wrap up, is there any sign that the U.S. Department of Interior is considering making these kind of changes?
You know, I think we've seen a lot of good things come out of President Trump's Department of Interior as far as trying to give states and communities more say in environmental and energy decisions. And so if that trend continues, I'm encouraged by what could be coming down the road for Native American communities, because I think Secretary Zinke is all about empowering the people who stand to benefit or be harmed by certain policies. And so I'm encouraged.
We'll leave it there for now. Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Katie Tubb is a policy analyst for the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. She was with us to talk about why she thinks the federal government, the U.S. Department of the Interior, should make it easier for Native American tribes to develop energy resources on their land.